Are you going on a tour?
Well, what kind?
Book tour, as such, per se.
Not really. I'm here this week seeing you and some others and doing some TV, and then L.A. next week.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do the Carson show and sing a couple of tunes and mix the two careers. And between these 2 weeks, that's it. I'm not going to Houston and Chicago and all. Because right after that, I'm going to Europe to do singing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do a set with one accompanying instrument, something I've never done, keep the background very lean, and see if I can break in that kind of show. I'm going to work Germany and Spain, Holland.
What's the instrument?
Piano.
Uh-huh. You?
Or me and piano. I'm not going to play. I'm going to work with Nicky Hopkins.
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit about you and some of the events leading up to Still Water. You grew up in Queens, and this, of course, is your first book of poems, but I can see through the dates at the bottom of each poem that you have been writing these for quite a few years now.
Yeah.
What kind of family did you... come from a literary-type family, musical family, or what?
Musical. Not professionally so, but Dad and Mom sang and harmonized around the house, just informally. My dad would play piano by ear. Oh, how we danced, da-da-dee. They were not literary, and they didn't go very far in their schooling. The fact that I went to Columbia College and then read a million books after school got me somewhat literarily inclined.
That's correct.
And words began to come to me a little freer, and so the choices of how to say various things I might want to say was somewhat at my command by the 80s. And I began to write these, to my surprise, when I had finished touring with Paul, because Paul Simon and I had done the concert in Central Park in 81, and then did 2 years of touring around the world. And as that was coming to an end, I began to look at my open schedule, and I remember being on a motorcycle in Switzerland thinking, we have one more show to do. I'm going to get ready for my next activity creatively. I think I'll spend this whole afternoon on the bike writing a poem about the stages of descent in the Alps. I'm coming down from 12,000 feet to this town. Let me see if I can describe how the landscape changes in each of the different stages. And I felt I had a bit of an embryo talent for it by the time I was finished. And that got me off and running. Next 2 days later, I had another inspiration for another idea. And this was the first time I began to be creative in the sense of bringing something into existence that wasn't. Because all the work I did with Paul Simon was with Paul as writer, and the two of us as singer and as producers. So here I was for the first time creating fully. And so I was beginning to get that kick of speaking from my mind and my memories and my angst.
It's interesting, that story is interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the way James Dickey, the poet, started. Mm-hmm. He was in World War II. He was in the Philippines, and he was walking along the side of a very dusty road, and he saw a row of flowers, and on those flowers was a fine sheen of dust. And Dickey looked at it, and he said, "That's remarkable." He said, "Somebody should write about that." And then he said, "No, I'll write it." And he did.
Right.
He did.
Right.
Of course, he had a stint as an advertising man in Atlanta. Coca-Cola was one of his accounts before he became a full-fledged poet. He also wrote, I think you recall, the movie Deliverance, which he played a bit role of the sheriff at the end. Dickey himself. Herbert Gold, who is a novelist based in San Francisco, has refused to show any of his poems to anybody, but he has decided that every day of his life he will get up in the morning and write a couplet. Something that he feels, something that he sees, something that he observes. And that's a wonderful way to express your ideas and thoughts, even though he has declined to seek a publisher for them.
I wonder if he shows them to wife and family or friends, because to write totally...
He's had many wives.
they all know his work. To write completely for oneself doesn't seem to be true. We write, when the pen hits the paper, there's some notion of someone on the other side of the paper.
It's a form of communication, isn't it?
So you have some idea of who you're communicating with, even if it's vague. To say that the person you're communicating with is the public at large, that is a leap of commerce. And that is an odd one. that requires some kind of ego expansion need or something, and I guess I've got that bug.
Well, a poem is an expression, and not in every instance, but in yours, certainly, an autobiographical effort to express a hurt, a longing, a feeling, a desire, a goal, an observation. And some of these things you can only do in poetic form. You just can't do it in any other way.
To care to write it out and to get it published, would it not be fair to say that you are trying to be of service to the human community, to risk and to be brave enough to tell your truth and risk the reviews of magazines so that you can add to common understanding what one person's honest truth is about? So surely that has to come from some kind of wish to be of service to the human race.
Yes, I think you're right. Also, there's another element, I think. Somebody told me this, and I had thought about it for a long time, and I believe it's absolutely correct. It's through a sense of poetry and through a sense of fiction. All poems don't have to be literally true, but they can express deep-rooted sensibilities and feelings and this sort of thing. So in many respects, poems are a form of fiction, which is why I keep poems on my fiction shelf. But it is through the art of poetry and through the art of fiction that we know what human beings actually feel in life.
In
nonfiction, you do not really get into the heart of a man or a woman. You can see what they do, see where they go. You can describe historical events and this sort of thing. But through fiction, you actually get into the skin of a person, or through poems, and how he feels as a human being.
Extremely necessary part of a culture. If you took it away, how would we know that our private, disturbing feelings are shared by the rest of the human race? We would have a much greater alienation and a sense of, I dare not show what makes me tick because it feels so unique or so odd. And we'd be much more in our corners. So the culture very badly needs to share the emotional truth of what a human being is, which we all are.
Well, in fact, I've read some fiction and some poetries that have shocked me in the past because they are so brutally honest. They would describe, for example, a very easy one, lust or a sexual longing. Mm. And when I grew up when I was a teenager in the 1950s and in my 20s in the 1960s, and in those days until the 60s really caught hold, nobody told you what lust was. There were some guidebooks and some signs. I remember driving across the Midwest with my father, and we stopped at a filling station, and inside the men's room there was a machine that sold condoms. Now, I had no idea what this machine was or what these condoms were, because it said sold for the prevention of disease only. You couldn't use it for any other purpose except to stop disease. So my father came in. I said, Dad, what is that?
Son, that's going to take a long explanation.
Well, almost. He said, I'll tell you later. Now, my father is now 82 years old, and he lives in Houston, Texas, and I am still waiting for him to tell me. They didn't tell you. But as you read, you would have descriptions of people in a fictional context or even poetic context describing lust or describing sex, and you could say to yourself, you know, I feel that way about myself. That's mean right. Other people feel that way? I can share these deep-rooted human emotions? Nonfiction writers don't tell you that.
I think the word bravery is relevant here, because to be a valid artist is to find the unique parts and disturbing parts of the self and to gamble that it's universal and to expose, and there's a kind of a courage.
Well, I have some questions about some of your poems.
Sure,
if you don't mind. Some of them are obviously deeply personal, and some of them I didn't understand because they deal with events or characters or happenings within your life that I don't know about. The poet Robert Lowell went through various phases of his poetic existence. He started out writing what you would call, I guess, Catholic poems. He was very concerned about faith and God and so forth. He later evolved into an autobiographical poet. And unless you knew his life, you would have virtually no idea what he's talking about. Toward the end of his life, his work obviously represented the man of a very deeply disturbed man, mentally ill man. So he went through these various phases. But in his autobiographical phase, I know a little bit about it now because I've read the Ian Hamilton biography of Lowell. So I know some of the people he's referring to and this sort of thing. But in your book, poem number 25, for example, you make mention of people. I mean, I know who Bird is, Laurie Bird. I was just trying to figure it out. Maybe you could explain the poem to me.
Well, okay, I guess I need to.
Oh, you don't have to.
I mean, didn't do it. It's
all right to create questions. You don't have to tell everything in a poem. You can,
of course,
a poem
but if
can
you
have
feel
many.
A little unsatisfied through lack of clarity, then I didn't do it.
It's not
well.
A lack of clarity. The poem is clear, except you're talking about some events that I'm not exactly sure what's happening here. So
in the late 70s, I was making an album called Watermark.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the mixing stage, I said to my lover, I need a few weeks to be completely in isolation to mix this.
No, we're talking about a different poem. Number 25.
Yes.
This is on page 43?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so Laurie Bird felt a little displaced to see me need to be so in isolation to do this. And she, somewhat put out by my needs, struck off on her own and was in, shortly after that, in this clothing shop in Los Angeles, and she ran into and befriended this girl, Gail.
Mm-hmm.
Gail became my friend as well through the years. And I wrote this poem about Gail's meeting of Laurie and how the two came together. Should I read it? Well, it's a long one, so we don't probably
well, I have a couple of more. I do want you to read a couple of poems.
Mm-hmm.
There's one, in fact, there's one, 34 is one I really especially liked, because I just like the reference to foils. And why don't you read that one? That's an especially a cunning poem, I think.
I walked to foils.
Excuse me, Art, let me get you a little closer to the mic.
This is what you write when you're remembering the days that you were first going to Europe. And in those days, I was with Paul, and we were busking, street singing in the streets of London. I walk to Foyle's, the bookshop. When I get to Charing Cross Road, green leaves are on the few remaining trees standing there at Denmark Street. 21 summers ago, I came to know this part of town. We sang Paul Simon songs and passed the hat around at Leicester Square. Kathy collected. She was 17. We were 22 then, and for a lovely little while. We were new to the plural of holiday. You went on them, on the continent, as a rule. In those days, you knew a thousand things to do to be cool. It's not so much that leaves turn brown. It's the trees themselves that are taken down, leaving a void around foils for me to understand. Once my heart was filled with the love of a girl, and the whole lush grove of the world was expanding. Today, green leaves are on the few remaining trees of Denmark Street, still standing.
Yeah, I like that one. That's a very nice poem.
Thanks. It helps to know I'm borrowing from an old Paul Simon song. The leaves that are green turn to brown is his tune. And those old fans of ours will see that reverberation in the poem.
Paul won't mind. Another one I liked because it reminded me of myself. At various phases of my life and at various times of the day and night. It's number 5. Maybe you could do that one for me.
Two champs, late in the night, were up to their 18th tequila. The wit, the rapport, the use of the metaphor made throwing up out of the question. See them now, 4 in the morning, the room reeling, guitar playing, waves of nausea filling the songs. Terrible private pain. There was a point of no return which he and I did pass. The tickle of the tonsils, the old heave-ho. We both said no and kept the rage to ride that coil of agony through the sunrise in the park. They cheered for us in the baseball parks. We strove for the hangover stage.
My story precisely.
18 tequilas, eh, Don?
Well, I think I've even done better than that on occasion. There is one poem in here.
It's my memory of Paul and I, this poem, and some of the behind-the-scenes difficulties. That one.
The poem that you wrote a couple of poems in here about your father, and the one I thought was particularly moving is number 70. I would assume... no, wait a minute. Yeah, number 70. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I presume this...
My dad died a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I presume this was something that led up to the death of your father.
Yeah, he died like 2 weeks after this event. Number 70. My dad, an apologetic man, a creature of old paltry habits, ardentest heart of all. He couldn't accept that his eyes were bad because they had done their term. He feared to sell the house he made so permanent. Quote, I want to be alive to do it, he told me. My books... My life, coins in a drawer, fans tramping through the door. I believe with my brother this summer the mason went home to his house to die. He dealt with the dentist. He kind of liked living alone, until one day Mrs. Slamowitz came to collect. A real estate broker, nothing more. What was he apologizing for? I believe he took the stairs too fast when he went up for the check.
It sounds like he was... holding out, wasn't he?
Well, you know how we, in order to keep our front face proper, we do a lot of behind-the-scenes machinations to the disservice of our health in order to make that dentist appointment or to get that broker's check from upstairs. And so you forget your real needs, you forget your age, your health. It makes me think, why did he put his own needs so secondary to the need to get that check from upstairs so that the broker can be paid?
I don't know that he necessarily forgot the needs to a certain degree. I have a feeling it's a unwillingness to accept the fact that the body changes. And mentally, in many respects, he may have felt the way he did when he was 30. Mm. You know what I mean? But the body can't carry that. Another very poignant poem is number 7, and this has to do with Laurie Bird.
Laurie was my love from 75 to 79, and really she went through me, and the 80s were reclusive for me because it was hard getting over her loss.
Would you care to read that one?
I will write my story backwards to February 79 to Laurie Bird when I saw her last in Long John's red one-piece monkey baby. We said goodbye one morning, was it March 3rd, in a fireplace room in Aspen. I flew off to Vienna. I cross-country skied first at the other end of Austria, practicing Milena in the snow. I spent 4 months with Milena, walked with her to her chosen suicide attempt in the story. Nick Rogue led me. Nick is a director, and I made a film with Teresa Russell, who had played Milena. But phoenix-like, she will rise in the final pages of my backwards book. Finally, what a sobbing writer I shall be then. With resurrection music, with Phil Spector's Old Man River, I will reveal how great our love, how great my loss. I'll span from here to there in sequence. Cycle 3 of Paul and Artie work to stave off a stumble. Excursions in Europe. Alexander Walker. Fan mail. My books. Central Park. Scissors cut. Her diaries. My three-tiered story. A. Our four-year history. B. My life February to August 79. C. The bad timing script. Her death. Our love. Her.
Has it helped you to write down some of these things that in some respects were hurtful periods in your life? Does it help?
I don't know. I think time is really what helps. And if you're trying to get over something that presses on the heart, I think really all you have is time. I don't know if you accelerate that process by seeing a shrink, writing a book, or lying on a couch. I think it helps to find someone new, but it's hard to find someone new when there's the obstacle of the past in the way.
Now, I've noticed that in my own case where there has been a tragedy, in fact, there was a suicide in my own family, and even after I had put the specific memory behind me, I would feel something in my chest. It would be, I knew I was depressed, but I couldn't remember exactly why. And then I would all of a sudden remember, that's why I'm depressed. Or when my mother died, I would forget about it. I'd go to work, or after my mother died, all of a sudden I would feel this almost like a thump, and I would begin to say, why am I feeling that? And then I would remember. So in a way, it's our bodies are kind to us in that respect, because the distance separates us.
Yeah, the body shuts down if it can't take in what's too painful. It can sip away, but it can't drink it. And it somehow says, I'll take in what I must in time, and only the body can know how to do that and how the time works. Yes, we get a break from the overwhelming nature of sad events that way.
You were studying for your PhD, weren't you?
Yeah.
Did you
spend a lot of years in Columbia? Yeah, I abandoned it when I started having hit records. I did a lot of years at Columbia. I got a bachelor's degree and went on to a master's, and then kept going in mathematics for a PhD, but I was singing with Paul all the time and working with the record company that's right here in this building.
That's right. You spent probably many days here at Columbia Records.
I know this building well.
Okay.
That kind of pull got me out of school.
Yeah, I had some fraternity brothers back in college. They called themselves the Four Winds, and they imitated everybody from the Four Lads of the Four Aces.
I remember those. Yeah, I like that period.
And
the Gaylords.
Oh, they imitated everything, the little of the Hilltoppers and so forth. And they got an RCA recording contract, and they made one or two records. It wasn't a big contract. Singles, you know, 45s. And they quit school. And they went out on the road. They toured in some nightclubs all over the country, made a few more records. And then the 60s came, and things kind of dried up, and they went back to college to finish. They all finished their degrees.
Yeah.
And now they're selling insurance, or every once in a while, I suppose, they get the old Vic recording out to hear Colorado Moon or She Wears Short Shorts, one of their cover records. But you actually started very early in the 50s with a recording, right?
Well, remember that Alan Freed, the disc jockey, came mm-hmm. to New York and invented the phrase rock and roll and started playing this subversive, exciting music in 1954. I was 13. Paul Simon lived three blocks away from me, same age. We both listened to the radio, as did many New Yorkers, and jumped on this wonderful rhythm and blues stuff from New Orleans and Chicago, this Chuck Berry, Little Richard stuff. And that the fact that our age was so in sync with that birth, and we were just being born into young adulthood, is really what was lucky for us. We had a hit record by the time we were 16. We spent those years practicing and going to New York with our hearts in our throats, making demos, knocking on doors of record companies. So all of that dealing with the fear of the audition kind of served us well. And having that hit and seeing the stresses and the nonsense of the distortions of the limelight, the flattery that goes with it, that was part of the education.
Probably pretty heady experience for young guys like that.
If you're a high school senior,
yeah.
You get into public performing, I think, in order to win the girls. That's the whole point of it, to impress the girls in the neighborhood. And after we had that initial hit and we broke up our friendship and our group, it was about 5 years later that we came together, started using the name Simon and Garfunkel instead of Tom and Jerry, which we were then, signed a contract with CBS. And then the world got to know us a year later through Sounds of Silence and those big hits.
Well, I'm going to tell you some very good news.
Good, Don.
I have, of course, when the Walkman phase came, I have all the Simon and Garfunkel albums, as those of us who were in our 20s in the 1960s had, and I recorded them onto cassettes, including the Boxer, which has a terrible scratch in it, click, 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 all the way through. So I resolved that after I finish the interview this afternoon, I'm going to go buy all of the Simon Garfunkel records that are on cassette, so I have fresh ones, you know, without all the surface noise and scratch and hiss and everything. Well, we're just about out of time, but I did want to ask you one more thing, because it's such an intriguing, interesting thing to do, something that I always thought I would like to do. For example, in the year about 1961, I was fired from my first radio television job from the station West Virginia. All I had was a Volkswagen, and I thought, here's a great time to go take my Volkswagen and drive across America. And I didn't have the guts, so I went out and found another job. at a radio station.
I know just what you mean.
But you are.
I'm walking across.
You're
the
walking
United
across.
States.
So tell me about this.
Well, your experience, having been fired, was a case of you're unprogrammed. The things you're connected to, you're suddenly unconnected to, and it gives you a wonderful philosophical chance to look at what comes next in your life and go, it's rather wide open. You know, life is not a programmed affair. It can be, if I just keep kindness about me, the rest can be whatever. I started this walking stuff when I took a freighter trip across the Pacific. I traveled alone, got to Japan for the first time and had never been there, and decided then and there I'm going to see the country on foot. And I checked what little baggage I had in the hotel, and I walked the country on foot. And I stayed in whatever inns I could find and walked through rice fields. And again, the Sony Walkman is a great friend for these things. If you're a singer, it's great to be out there and use the clean air and the isolation to sing. Since that was such a wonderful success, I set off to cross America some years ago. I remember the day I left my apartment and put the sneakers on, went through Central Park, Columbia University, Grant's Tomb, the George Washington Bridge, Fort Lee, New Jersey. 8 days later, I crossed the Delaware into Pennsylvania. Then I came home and picked up on this walk some months later and added the next leg across the Amish country of southeast Pennsylvania into Maryland. And now I've added about 15 more legs to the trip. I'm in Lincoln, Nebraska now.
Are you doing this by yourself?
I keep going out, sometimes by myself, sometimes I take my bride with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I go all different ways. Usually I'm alone. I have my notebook in case I want to write.
It's not lonely.
I'm used to that lonely. That word lonely is an old friend of mine. I live half my life in that solitary place, mostly happy. I think I can fool myself about loneliness pretty well.
You are taking, you said you're taking a notebook.
Yeah.
So you, thank goodness for that, because we can see another volume, Stillwater 2.
We'll see.
At some point. But it's maybe premature to ask you, maybe it's an unfair question, that would be my last one, but I don't know how many hundreds of miles you've covered on foot.
About 1,600.
1,600. You've seen a lot of country. You probably talked to a lot of people. Is there anything special that you have learned or observed up to this point in your travels, just by this very walk?
Yes, the world is pretty much a safe place. That's what I keep learning. It is not dark and scary out there. It's about us, human beings, trying to have happy lives without causing other people damage to the best of their ability. And yes, we do hurt each other, but if one looks to stay out of trouble, one pretty much finds others will leave you be. And if you bring a smile and bring good-heartedness to other people, just about everyone will return the same in kind.
Well, this does lead to one more question, and this will definitely be my last. You mentioned the people. What most of us, especially if we live in New York, I've lived in New York now for more than 20 years, and in New York you don't talk to strangers very often. A woman came up to me on the street corner today on my way to the CBS because it was raining, but the sun was out, right? It was very bizarre. I even got my umbrella, and I saw the sun and the rain, and this woman came up, and she nudged me on the shoulder. You do this in New York. And she was laughing. She said, isn't this amazing? Look, the sun is up, and it's raining.
It's so un-New York.
Yeah, and, you know, I was put off for a moment, and I said, well, maybe we could find a rainbow up there. And then I walked off. But normally you wouldn't do that.
No, that's a real out-of-towner's point.
Yeah. But as you walked across America, have you talked to people, and have you found, what kind of people are Americans?
I think they are people who are a little uninspired. We are part of a country that doesn't have any great nobility about itself or any great vision. The only vision I see is the desire to make money. I don't know what we stand for now. We're good-hearted people, but we don't know what this is all in the service of in terms of a direction. Our direction is space, but that's not good enough. What is our direction in terms of the values of the country? So I feel for people because I know they're doing the best they can without a sense of inspiration for the country. Now, people have their own personal inspiration, but I wish the culture had areas of height that would pull us up and I don't see it.
Well, on a slightly pessimistic note, Art Garfunkel, I've enjoyed your music over all these years. Many of these poems are quite nice and extremely moving. I thank you very, very much.
Thanks for the nice words, Dan.